Hello, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. You can subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk, and check out show notes and various other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Remember, there's a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. You can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Purchasing through that deal is cheaper than Amazon, and it's also a good way to directly support Turkey Book Talk. Books included on the list are written by authors who have featured on this podcast at some point. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eşref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poison Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. To order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit the page for the offer, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com, and help support Turkey Book Talk. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, is through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want, and you can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But let's get going with this latest episode, and in it I speak to Esra Gürakar, who's the author of Politics of Favoritism in Public Procurement in Turkey, Reconfigurations of Dependency Networks in the AKP Era, which is published by Palgrave Macmillan. The title's a bit of a mouthful, but the book is actually a very sharp account of corruption in contemporary Turkey. This interview comes after fresh revelations in May about multi-million dollar bribery scandals channeled through offshore accounts based in Malta and involving senior Turkish government officials. I'll put links to those reports on armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com so you can judge for yourself. Contracts for infrastructure work are one of the main drivers of corruption in today's Turkey. Esra Gürakar's book examines the issue through changes to the public procurement law. Basically, the law was introduced after Turkey's huge economic crisis in 2002 in order to make such contracts more transparent and efficient. But the AKP government made over 150 amendments to the law in subsequent years, essentially reopening the door to widespread cronyism and favouritism. I started by asking Esra Gürakar to outline the details of the public procurement law change in 2002 and to compare the situation before and after the AKP came to power that same year.
In 2002, Turkey drafted a new public procurement law with the push of IMF, World Bank and EU. And right before its enactment, AKP, as a total new political party, came to power as the majority government. And it started to amend the procurement law, but very severely. I mean, AKP wanted to postpone its enactment, but because there were like severe criticisms both in the country and among the international financial institutions and the EU, it couldn't do so, but chose a different path and started to amend the law. Since AKP came to power, the public procurement law has been amended more than 150 times. And what motivated me to write this book was to find out why the AKP majority government was passing laws that was amending the public procurement law that severely. I wanted to find out if the AKP government was in an effort to distribute public resources to some AKP affiliated companies. As I said, corruption is not unique to AKP government. But if you ask me if there is a difference between pre-2002 and post-2002 in terms of public procurement policy and corruption in public procurement, I would say yes. What is the difference? The difference is corruption in public procurement in the pre-2002 pre-AKP period used to occur, irregularly on an individual basis. Let's say one minister favoring the firm of, I don't know, his cousin or his son-in-law, or one bureaucrat favoring a couple of firms which bribe him. But during AKP, corruption in public procurement has started to occur in a more systematic way. It's more centralized and occurs in a more systematic way through making notorious and highly debated laws. So that was my main motivation, why the AKP government is amending this new public procurement law, which was drafted and enacted with the aim of fostering transparency, competitiveness, accountability, as well as to depoliticize the public procurement processes.
You talked there about 2002 was really this kind of watershed moment, because this law was passed actually just before the AKP came to power, and mm-hmm. then they saw it through mm-hmm. in 2003. And the thinking behind this law was to really open up the procurement system, really. It was to make it more transparent, to make it less corrupt, and to reduce kind of political discretion, really, mm-hmm. in terms of providing bribes and special deals for politically mm-hmm. connected firms. Mm-hmm. And what happened, as you describe in the book, over the course of the next few years was that it was reformed and changed. And really the original aim of the law was, over time, gradually over the course of over 100 amendments, basically reversed.
Yes, apparently. I mean, it was not like that, like, you know, in 2002, all of a sudden, the government of that time decided that, oh, this system is very corrupt, so let's reform the system. No, it was not like that. The public procurement processes used to be governed under another law called state procurement law. And this state procurement law was flawed. It was deficient. And the procurement processes were politicized, were not carried out within a transparent framework, and many illegal practices used to emerge in the procurement processes. But what happened is that in the 1990s, we were kind of like used to reading all these corruption scandals in the newspapers, and we also were used to having all these recurring economic crises of 1994, 1997, and then we had this 2001 financial crisis that literally brought the economy to the edge of collapse. And this 2001 financial crisis was indeed kind of like very important, because it forced Turkey's politicians to take some serious steps in institutional reform. Of course, it also clashed with the EU membership process, because in 1999 in Helsinki, Turkey's official candidacy was declared. So Turkey was there eager to be a member of the EU, and in 2001 had this financial crisis, desperately in need of money, and comes IMF, says, okay, you really need this public sector reform for this credit. So this public sector reform, which also included drafting a new public procurement law, came as a loan conditionality, aid conditionality, candidacy conditionality. So Turkey, confronted with three external anchors, World Bank, IMF, and the EU, had really had to undertake steps to reform its economic institutional structure. And the public procurement was one of the major areas. And the new law, for instance, was to be discussed and agreed with the EU and the World Bank on the basis of the essential standards of like transparency, accountability, and competitiveness. So it was not like the government of that time saying, okay, this procurement system is not transparent enough, so we are changing it. No, it was the external push, indeed. They were forced to do that. What happened is that like this new law really substantially extended the scope of the law. The procurements of the majority of the state institutions became subject to the law, introduced some explicit rules of qualification, the qualification for participation, etc. They became more explicit. And as I said, public procurement authority as an independent regulatory agency was established. What was it like before the establishment of public procurement authority? It was the job of Ministry of Public Works and Settlement and the Ministry of Finance. So what happened is that the regulation of public procurement process was taken from these two ministries to be given to the public procurement authority with an aim to depoliticize the public procurement processes. But what happened is that all these improvements in the public procurement system used to contradict with the pre-election promises of AKP. One of the most important pre-election promises of AKP was building 15,000 kilometers of highways. And Recep Tayyip Erdogan Erdogan, right after becoming the prime minister, clearly stated, like said, the current version of the public procurement law, he's talking about the new law, serves the interests of the 50-60 firms only, the oldest, the most established 50, 60 or 100 construction firms of Turkey. And he says, I am not going to leave the construction work of 15,000 kilometers of highways to 60 contractors. So what he did, he started to amend the law because spawning was kind of like impossible because why AKP was not that strong at that time when first elected. Erdogan also knew that AKP's success was a byproduct of the collective action among the business spheres of Anatolia, who was unhappy about the previous unequal distribution of rents during 1980s and 1990s. So he really needed to create some opportunity spaces for the Anatolian tigers, we call them. And construction has been among the most important sectors, as we all know, that AKP puts the most importance on. So what he did, the majority government, more than 35 different laws have been passed in the parliament, which made more than 150 amendments to the new public procurement law. So what happened with these laws that amended the public procurement law is that the scope of the public procurement law has been narrowed. The scope of the relatively less transparent auction methods has been extended. Unfortunately, the financial and administrative autonomy of the public procurement authority have been curtailed. What else? Some ad hoc monetary limits. These ad hoc monetary limits were the clear signs of favoritism, and the book indeed systematically demonstrates how these legal amendments have been used to favor some privileged firms.
On a political level as well, it's a very symbolic set of changes because the original law that was passed in 2002 was really passed not just with an eye on the IMF and the World Bank, but it was also part of the EU reforms that the government was pursuing in the first few years in power. This was part of the aim, and then as it was amended and as the law was made less transparent and more open to favouritism, basically it was a kind of move away from that target of EU membership or reaching the kind of standards demanded by Brussels.
Yes, so it was a kind of like three types of external push from IMF, from World Bank and the EU. Indeed, the framework required by the IMF and the World Bank was in line with the Copenhagen Declaration. So it was kind of like you're doing this public sector reform and you'll have this IMF credit, this World Bank aid, and you will take some steps in harmonization with the EU procurement directives. And you will go one more step forward in meeting the Copenhagen criteria.
Also, it struck me as I was reading the book, I mean, you write about how infrastructure development and particularly construction was really useful for the government as part of the political narrative that it pushed, because it combined this idea of development that was very appealing to voters. But it also provided this opportunity to cultivate kind of cronyistic ties with companies.
Mm-hmm.
So it basically kind of killed two birds with one stone there. It served an economic purpose to reinforce the government in power, but it also served a political purpose to appeal to voters. Could you just talk a bit about this dual dynamic?
Yes, indeed. While I was working on this book, I have realized that the AKP's durability can to a large extent be explained by its success in establishing, maintaining and developing a set of extensive networks of privileges and dependency networks. Through these dependency networks, AKP maintains its ties both with the private sector firms and the voters, using new methods for creating and allocating resources, let's say. And public procurement seems to be one of the most influential tools used by the AKP government to build and expand the dependency networks. I would say the system has three main building blocks: rent creation via lawmaking, like these highly debated laws, rent distribution employed to create AKP-dependent private sector firms. And finally, new forms of reallocating resources to the waters. What I mean by new forms of reallocating resources to the waters is, like, for instance, at the local level, for instance, the shareholders and the board members of the contract awarded firms, around 1,200 of them have either shareholders or board members directly connected to the AKP, like serving as AKP cadres or relative of Erdogan. This could be like family of the daughter-in-law of Erdogan. This could be an MP. This could be provincial head. So at the local level, this new form of reallocating resources functions like this. So the party relies on politically connected firms for donations. So you get the contract, then you donate. And then it relies on municipalities for targeting the people in need, the potential voters. And then relies on Islamic NGOs for distributing the resources. So that's what I mean by this new forms of reallocating resources. So in this way, the AKP government very successfully both touches upon the very leaves of the waters through, for instance, social housing projects or municipal services, while at the same time empowering its own business elite through procuring these construction work projects or municipal services from the privileged private sector firms. And with the donations of these privileged firms, the party helps some other voters or potential voters. And it's not seen as a right by the voter. It's not like, you know, I'm paying taxes, so I deserve it. No, it's in the form of aid, like charitable giving, rather than like, you know, systematic rights. And as I said, many of the firms, like around 60% of the procurement contracts go to these politically connected firms with owners, shareholders, board members actively working or as, I don't know, provincial party leader, municipal council member or an MP or their close relatives of AKP officials or their leading members of organizations affiliated with the AKP. This could be AKB, this could be Ensar, etc.
I also want to address this question of inefficiency, because people often imagine that corruption is just this kind of purely moral issue. But you emphasize in the book this important point that actually corruption is enormously wasteful. You know, it directs resources in inefficient ways, and instead of providing value for money for various projects, it's the priority isn't to strike a good deal. It's just to strike, you know, what is a politically convenient deal. And often, of course, it's citizens who end up paying for it. Recently, there's been a number of reports about this question of state guarantees. So yeah. Basically, like, infrastructure projects are commissioned by the state. The contracts are awarded. So, for example, with the third bridge over the Bosphorus, there have been reports that it's been underperforming. So the company that is responsible for that was actually given a guarantee by the state before bidding. And mm-hmm. because the take from the fee of people crossing the bridge in cars hasn't been as high as the guarantee said it would be, the state ends up paying the company that's operating the bridge, or as a kind of almost a compensation to make up for the price that they are apparently missing out on based on the calculations that they made before bidding for the contract.
In a way, yes, but projects like Third Bridge or the new Istanbul Airport, these projects are exempted from the scope of the public procurement law. These projects are named as public-private partnership. This is another problematic issue about public procurement in Turkey, because when the public procurement law was first drafted, energy, telecommunication, transportation projects were also under the scope of the law, but right after its enactment, such projects like the Third Bridge or the new Istanbul Airport or some energy investments were all exempted from the public procurement law. This is not that problematic, because normally in the EU countries as well, like energy, transport, telecommunication projects are exempted from the public procurement law. But what happens in these EU countries is that there's another framework that governs these projects. But in Turkey, what happens is that although these projects have been exempted from the public procurement law, the government, in spite of all the pressure coming from EU, has has remained reluctant to form a new coherent framework to govern these projects. So they're all governed one by one. So there's no kind of coherent structure to govern all these big projects. And in terms of state guarantee, yeah, this is what everyone is talking. I mean, again, state guarantee, Turkey used to have this state guarantee application. And when the AKP came to power, it was proud of announcing that state guarantee would never apply again. And now we have it again. Yeah.
Another important factor is that you also address in the book that's less mentioned in the news, but is very important, I think. It's this almost total emasculation of the Court of Accounts in recent years. And now this court was previously tasked with overseeing the budgets of various public institutions and the use of public resources. But basically, I don't know for how many years, but for at least the last like 4 or 5 years, it's really been non-functional. It's been rendered non-functional by various parliamentary motions and bylaws. Could you just talk a bit about this aspect?
Unfortunately, yes, you're right. It was this law. It was 2013, as far as I remember. And the parliament passed a law that would kind of like, you know, dismantle all checks and balances or like curb all the authority of the Court of Accounts. And luckily, that time, the draft law was partially cancelled by the Constitutional Court. But what was sad about this is that the media considered this cancellation, a partial cancellation of the law or rejection of the law, was revolution. So it was 2013, and since then, the Court of Accounts is not functioning properly, and we keep reading or hearing about Court of Accounts drafting fake audits. Some municipalities, the majority, the AKP municipalities, are not being audited. We even read about copy-paste audit reports, and these are major problems about audits in Turkey. As far as I remember, this was before this 2013 law, the Court of Accounts decided to exclude the public law section from its audit reports for the year 2011. And this apparently led public losses by state institutions to go unrecorded. And what else? Oh, and also, yeah, right after that, with another regulatory change for the years 2013, 14, and 15, the Ministry of Finance was authorized to forward consolidated and brief reports on the spending of government institutions to the Court of Accounts. So this was also a major impediment to full inspection of government institutions' spending for another 3 years. And currently, there is an ambiguity of the types of audits that the Turkish Court of Accounts can conduct. What's also interesting is that the audit reports for pre-2012 have been removed from the website. So it's kind of like, you know, reducing the accessibility and transparency of external audit. And I did read the EU-Turkey progress report for the last year, and there it was saying that the Court of Accounts referred only 28 cases to Public Prosecutor's Office between 2004-2014, in 10 years. And among these 28 cases, 70 was in 2014, the year of corruption and graft scandal. And I checked 2015 and saw that Court of Accounts referred only 6 cases implicating corruption to the prosecution office in 2015. So yeah, it's not functioning very well. And today I read that such a kind of legally ambiguous environment and decreasing credibility of the Turkish Court of Accounts audit, also because of the state of emergency rules, because, you know, detention warrants issued for hundreds of Court of Accounts employees as well over Gulenlinks. And you can also read everywhere there's this massive transfer of assets to newly established wealth fund, which is exempted from the audit of the Turkish Court of Accounts. So in such a legally, as I said, ambiguous environment and an environment where the credibility of the Court of Accounts is decreasing, not surprisingly, today I read the European Court of Auditors announced on Tuesday that it will audit EU financial support for Turkey in order to check whether money has been used properly. So it's kind of saddening indeed.
And finally, you also make the point in the book about how this isn't just a question of the central government being responsible for these problems. You also talk a bit, you examine the data at a local level. I think you mentioned the Izmir municipality in West Turkey, which is held by the opposition CHP. Mm-hmm. And you show that on the local level, those local municipalities often also exhibit similar favouritism towards friendly companies. Could you talk a bit about this aspect as well?
Yeah, indeed, I was expecting this. That is why I did not only construct a politically connected firm data only for the governing party, but the opposition party as well, because I kind of doubt that. So in the municipalities governed by AKP, the politically connected firms connected to AKP get kind of like 3/4 of the contracts. But what is interesting is that in Izmir municipality, for instance, which is governed under CHP, the municipality also exercises discretion in favor of the firms politically connected to the main opposition party, CHP. So almost half of the procurement contracts awarded by Izmir municipality goes to firms connected to main opposition party. But yes, of course, I mean, like the total value of contracts awarded by Izmir municipality is much, 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 much less than the contracts awarded by the municipalities, say Ankara and Istanbul. For instance, Ankara and Istanbul procures around 7 times higher in terms of value than Izmir municipality. But still, I indeed interviewed with HP MPs about the issue, and I asked why the tendency is similar. They said that because AKP is exercising excessive control both at central and local levels, firms that are not affiliated with the AKP are put in a disadvantageous position through numerous legal arrangements that impede competition. In such an uncompetitive environment, they say, this municipality is left with no other options other than protecting these firms.
I suppose also they could say, going back to the original point that we were making at the beginning, really, that there's a different situation with what was going on before the AKP came to power, because really no other government before the AKP has been in power for 15 years in Turkey. And over the course of those 15 years, it's really been able to just collect all the authority in the centre there and monopolising all institutions. And over that time, it's had more scope to fully exploit all the opportunities of that power.
Yeah, not only that, also AKP won the majority of the seats in the parliament and formed a majority government for the first time since 1987. After that, after Özal, Turkey never, I mean, between Özal and AKP, Turkey didn't have a majority government. So it had some indigenous checks and balances through coalition. One wanted to say yes to something, the other said no. This made it quite hard, many times Tayyip Erdoğan talks about this. But in a way, it was kind of an indigenous form of checks and balances for a country like Turkey.
That was Esra Gurakar. Thank you very much to her. Remember, Turkey Book Talk listeners can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available and to order using that discount, buying a book and directly supporting this podcast at the same time, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. You can also support this podcast if you enjoy and benefit from it via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan Marcus Rommel, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, and Andrew McDowell. Remember to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes. And email recommendations, feedback, or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until we meet again in a couple of weeks, thanks a lot for listening.